Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as, well, an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is a privilege each week to be able to consult with a man who is very astute and closely following one of the most important fronts in that war, namely Asia. He is Gordon Chang. You see him on Fox. You read him, I'm sure, at Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com and in many other outstanding outlets. We're always very pleased to have him here with us, and never more so than today. Gordon, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Frank.
A couple of things that are hot at the moment. Gordon, of course, China is playing a very prominent role in the so-called global climate change negotiations now underway in Paris. President Obama has addressed the group earlier. Xi Jinping has done so, I believe, as well. What do you make of China's role in all of this? Are they to be relied upon as a constructive participant in such talks? Are they serious about reducing their pollution and other contributions to global climate change, or is this all much ado about nothing?
I think there are two important aspects to China's participation in the so-called COP21 talks in Paris. First of all, they want carbon caps now, which is something that they haven't done before. But of course, they want the developed world, in other words, the United States, to bear the brunt of carbon reduction. China has committed to a carbon cap of whatever it puts in the air in 2030, which really is not much of a cap at all. And so the whole issue of disproportionality is going to be front and center in Paris. The second thing, and this is a point of disagreement between the United States and China, which is direct and immediate, the Chinese want a binding agreement to come out of the Paris climate talks. The United States does not. And the reason is President Obama realizes that he cannot get a treaty through the Senate. For instance, we also know that President Obama can't even get the Congress to approve a $3 billion contribution to the Global Climate Fund, which the president pledged before. So this is another area where the United States and China will go to loggerheads in Paris.
Do you anticipate that those disagreements will be sufficient, Gordon, to prevent another agreement?
I think that the betting is that there will not be a legally binding agreement coming out of Paris. I think that there will be a framework understanding that countries will adhere to, but this is still very much up in the air. India is the country that is probably going to be the main roadblock to a climate arrangement, largely because its economy is at a much earlier stage of takeoff than China. It needs more ability to put carbon in the air, they believe, than the Chinese do. The Chinese have basically topped out their carbon contribution to global warming. They know it. So they're going to probably be more flexible than New Delhi.
But as you say, the point is that they will reserve the right to continue increasing the use of carbon and for that matter, pollution until 2030 at the very earliest, I take it.
Absolutely. And so this is this whole issue of disproportionality. China is the world's largest carbon emitter by far. And if there's going to be any progress on climate change, it's going to be because the Chinese are not going to be putting as much into the air because their economy is in trouble. Their manufacturing sector is already contracting. And that means this year, their increase in carbon to the environment is 0.24%, according to Bloomberg New Energy Finance. That means the Chinese have already peaked well before 2030.
Let me turn to another issue that you're following closely, and we've talked about it a lot over the years, Gordon, and that is the extent to which the Chinese have been angling to have the renminbi, their currency, become one of the world reserve currencies, displacing perhaps the dollar. An important development in that regard seems to be in the offing today. Talk a little bit about it.
today, the IMF is expected to include the renminbi in the basket of currencies for special drawing rights. Now, by definition, if your currency is in that basket, you are a reserve currency. The dollar, the euro, the yen, and the pound are already in the basket. This is important for China in terms of obtaining recognition for its status for its currency. But this is one of those things that China should not be wishing for at this stage, because it makes it much more difficult for Beijing to control the renminbi. And we're going to see, I think, countries start playing the renminbi to China's disadvantage. You know, at this point right now, the IMF is actually violating its own standards by putting the renminbi in the SDR basket because it's not freely convertible and as usable as the IMF wants everyone to believe. But nonetheless, they're making a political decision. And the reason they're doing this is they're trying to give encouragement to those small band of reformers in Beijing who want to loosen their currency. Now, they're not going to be able to do it, especially in a time of economic distress. So the IMF is trying to encourage something that Beijing can't do right now because of the problems that is facing the currency, which right now there's significant downward pressure. We're going to see the renminbi fall quite a lot because companies and countries are going to dump it.
And to the extent that the currency manipulation has been a festering sore with the United States in its trade relations, among other things, Gordon, how will that be affected by this apparent diminution of China's ability to control its currency?
Well, right now, Beijing is manipulating its currency, but it's keeping it at a value that is far higher than the market wants it to be. So now, you know, essentially, Charles Schumer, the senator from New York, has been complaining about China's currency manipulation. Well, he's right, but to the wrong side. Now, this is a difference from decades of China's manipulating its currency downward to gain a trade advantage. They've actually manipulated their currency upwards to get into the SDR basket. So this is a reversal of the normal state of things. But China has been spending hundreds of billions of dollars recently to defend its currency. Its foreign reserves have fallen by their own estimate by $500 billion, probably more like $1 trillion in the last 18 months. This is a very bad situation for Beijing. They want to be in the SDR basket so they can then stop manipulating their currency up. We can expect the renminbi to fall and probably fall by about 25 to 30%, let's say, in the next 9 months or so.
Gordon, that's just another of the straws in the wind that we monitor with you each week. And again, our guest is the author of The Coming Collapse of China. You have written more recently, Gordon, about the possibility that China may be heading towards a 1930s-style crash, in part, top of everything else, as a result of the net capital outflow of staggering proportions. Give us a flavor of the latest on that and whether Justin Trudeau of Canada, among others, is making a bad bet on the future of China's economy.
Well, in the third calendar quarter of this year, China suffered something like $460.6 billion of capital outflow, according to Bloomberg. In October, it was moderated to $62 billion of outflow. That's because China has been putting informal clamps on outbound transfers of currency. This is serious. China is misreporting its foreign exchange reserves from all we can tell, trying to minimize the appearance of the fall in the reserves. Now, Justin Trudeau, the newly elected prime minister in Canada, wants better relations with Beijing. His father, of course, Pierre Trudeau, was pretty much a Marxist, and that sort of runs in the Trudeau family. They've been very friendly to China. I think that Canada is going to be disappointed, largely because of the problems in the manufacturing sector in China. China is just not going to import as much in the way of Canadian commodities that Trudeau hopes. So I think that Trudeau is banking on something that's not going to occur. We've seen this, of course, with the Australians who've been disappointed in the last 2.5 years or so because the Chinese are not buying as much iron ore from Australia and other minerals. So this is going to be another story of disappointment. And I think eventually Trudeau is going to have to realize that the problems in China are much more severe than he is willing to admit.
That, too, we will be following closely with your good help, Gordon Chang, at Forbes.com, WorldAffairsJournal.com, frequently at Fox News, among other outlets. We appreciate your time with us each week, Gordon, and most especially, really, the very clear-eyed view that you've maintained of China over quite some time. It's a clarity that's needed, not just in the fog of the Paris talks, but in Washington and other capitals as well. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Michael Rowan joins us. We'll talk about the coming elections in Venezuela and what they might mean for us. More straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country. The one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Michael Rowan, columnist for El Universal and Veneconomia in Venezuela. He is also the author of The Threat Closer to Home, Hugo Chavez and the War Against America. Numerous other publications, as well as, of course, his columns, cause him to be one of our duty experts on what's going on in Latin America, and he's always a welcome guest here. Michael, good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on. Thanks.
Well, you have been following very closely developments in Venezuela for a long time. As I've indicated, you've written a book on Hugo Chavez. His successor has proven, if anything, to be worse in terms of what he's done to the economy, to the freedoms of the people of Venezuela. An election is looming wherein his future may be decided, and perhaps that of Venezuela as well. Tell us a little bit about what's at stake as you see it and how you think it might come out.
Well, first of all, you know, Venezuela is only pretending to be a democracy. It's a military regime, basically. It's an oil and cocaine mafia, and that's essentially what it is. It does pretend to be. It's running elections and so on, but they haven't had a fair election since 2004, which is the last time that anybody looked at the voting list.
And one of the leading candidates for the opposition is, of course, a political prisoner at the moment under Maduro. Is that right?
Yes. You know, Leopoldo López was put in prison, and there are actually 70 political prisoners in Venezuela now, which is a disgrace for the Americas. But, you know, people are ignoring this. This is happening right next to us, and pretty much what is going on in Venezuela is it's kind of like what Pablo Escobar was trying to do in Colombia in the 90s, where you had the Medellin cartel, you know, assassinating candidate for president Galan.
Our guest is Michael Rowan. He is a past president of the International Association of Political Consultants, has been active in that space for a long time, as well as an author of columns and books that commend himself to us as an expert on the Latin American scene. And you were talking about sort of Pablo Escobar as the model for what's happening in Venezuela, in the difference being that he was a bandit, as he called himself. These guys are running the government. What does that suggest in terms of the level of narcotics activity and the ability through Iranian and other sources to enable it to be a really formidable threat from the terrorist point of view as well, Michael Rowan?
Well, there's a very interesting connection between the drugs and the passports and the terrorism, and the money laundering, too. So when you're running a drug cartel, and basically 50% of all the cocaine in the world is now going through the Caracas Channel, and that's coming from the FARC, which is the guerrillas in Colombia, are now in control of what the Medellin cartel and the Cali cartel used to run. It's now run by guerrillas. And you're talking about, you know, $1 billion or $2 billion per month of cash flow. So this is an enormous, huge effect in both in Colombia and in Venezuela. Now, in Venezuela, the narco-terrorists basically are the government. So you have, you know, this big cover up with these military guys, and which went from Chavez to Maduro, that we're running elections and we're running an economy and yada yada. But it's basically a kleptocracy in which they're stealing the oil and cocaine money, and they've become billionaires. There's several of them that have become billionaires. So they're publishing, you know, passports for Islamic militants. Iran is there. Hezbollah is there. Hezbollah makes its money with drugs back in the Middle East. And, you know, FARC and Hezbollah are right there together with kidnapping and cocaine income now in Venezuela and in Colombia. So that's the situation we're dealing with. So really, from a U.S. perspective, we've got to think about why we are supporting this regime, and we are.
And that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, but put it in the context of this December 6th National Assembly election, Michael Rowan. How is that likely, in your judgment, to
play out. Is there any chance under the circumstances that this could be a free and fair election, or even one in which there's an actual contest? Or is it a completely rigged game that will result in yet another mandate, if you will, for this this narco-terrorist sponsoring regime?
Well, the polls are showing it's either an 80-20 against the government election, or it's 90-10. So, they're trying to affect the turnout with the assassinations and the intimidation and so on that's going on there, as we talked about before. But it doesn't really matter. I mean, basically, it's a non-observed election. You don't have any objective observers there. You only have like Iran and Cuba looking at this, to legitimize an election.
Yeah, not likely to conduce to a free and fair election. And yet we've had the Organization of American States, Secretary General, send a letter, a very, very strong letter, 18 pages worth, documenting the problems with this election process. We've had 157, I think it is, legislators from the United States and elsewhere condemning it. Is there anything that can be done at this point, Michael Rowan, that would actually put pressure on this regime to change course and perhaps give the people of Venezuela an alternative?
Well, I think that there are, I don't think there's anything we could do between now and next Sunday to make this thing work, because these guys are arranging this in order to keep power that they've had for 16 years. And there's so much crime and so many killings and theft. It is impossible for them to get into a joint government or have anybody look at what they did. So no, there's nothing they're not going to yield power. And so there's going to be a lot of condemnation. And the question is what is the U.S. going to do with that? Are they going to sanction dollar transactions with the Venezuelan military? Are they going to declare PDVSA a RICO organization, which is really what it is? Are they going to stop the false Venezuela passports coming into the U.S., which the FBI and the Homeland Security people are looking at? Are they going to have a state sponsor of terror study done on Venezuela so that we can coordinate off, isolate it?
Designated as such, because it certainly is. Well, all of the above seem to be in order. The question, I guess, is will the kinds of results that we're all expecting, namely the theft of this election and further predations on the people of Venezuela by this government, catalyze the sorts of things you're talking about? And I'm particularly of the view, as I think you are, Michael Rowan, that we ought to be designating this country, this government, I should say, as what it is, a terrorist-sponsoring regime.
Well, I think all the evidence is there, and I think on the 6th, on Sunday, they have the election, and let's talk a couple of days later and see we have a new president in Argentina who has already, Macri, got elected, and so now we have a centrist and not, a clone of Chavez running the Argentina, and Argentina has already moved to kick Venezuela out of Mercosur. So will they start to? Will Chile and Argentina step up? Will Colombia?
And will we? Is the key question, of course, Michael Rowan. We've got to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you very much, as always, for your insights and for your expertise. I look forward to that conversation with you in the days following the election this weekend in Venezuela, seeing what we can do to make this come out rather better. Michael Rowan, God bless you. Take care, my friend.
Next up, columnist and pundit DeRoy Murdoch joins us on what we should be doing about the Islamic State and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. World leaders meet in Paris today, promising their country's adherence to an arbitrary, scientifically dubious cap on global warming. For his part, President Obama will commit us to economy-disrupting greenhouse gas reductions and transferring many billions of dollars from American taxpayers to the Third World. Fortunately, the U.S. Senate took bipartisan initiatives last week intended to show Obama and his foreign interlocutors that Congress opposes these cockamamie initiatives. The House of Representatives is expected to do the same shortly. But President Obama says he won't submit the Paris Agreement to congressional review, and that he'll veto legislation critical of it. Congress must nonetheless try to spare us the double whammy of traumatizing America's economy and unaccountably redistributing vast wealth from this country to developing nations by cutting off funding for whatever climate change gambit Obama agrees to in Paris. This is Frank Affney.
They are fathers and mothers, someone's best friend, and America's true heroes. Whether out on the front lines or here on the home front, our troops are sacrificing every day, making sure that we continue to have the freedoms that make this country great.
Hi, I'm Congressman Chris Stewart. As a former Air Force pilot, I understand that our troops and their families continue to give so much for our country. Let them know you appreciate their service. A simple thank you can go a long way.
Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. It's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here.
Do this better than any station in town.
Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. October 18th marked an important date for the nuclear deal with Iran. On this date, Adoption Day, the U.S. and the EU had to affirm that they will lift sanctions when the IAEA certifies that Iran has met several easy-to-meet requirements, probably later this year. The Iranian parliament had to agree to provisionally approve the NPT additional protocol, which gives IAEA inspectors greater access to Iranian nuclear sites. Meanwhile, however, Iranian leaders have made it clear they will not fully comply with the nuclear deal. Iran recently tested a long-range missile in violation of the deal. Tehran also placed some military sites off-limits to IAEA inspectors. In addition, Iran recently sent troops to Syria, probably paid for with sanctions relief from the nuclear deal. It is becoming more and more clear that critics who said last July that this deal is a sham had it exactly right. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by DeRoy Murdoch. He is a nationally syndicated columnist. He is the author of innumerable extraordinary pieces, including quite a number at National Review. He is a Fox News contributor. Has been, well, just extraordinarily insightful, it seems to me, on a whole host of issues, and most recently has been turning his critical eye towards the Islamic State and what we are doing about it, or more to the point, not doing about it, not doing anything effective about it, at least. DeRoy Murdoch, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Frank, great to be with you.
Well, let's get this straight at the first. Is the Islamic State the problem, DeRoy, or is it a symptom of a larger problem? It doesn't excuse not taking it, you know, seriously. I'm just asking whether, in your estimation, it's the only game in town, and if we got it right, whether we would be far better off, or whether we really have to address the what I think of as the global jihad movement as well.
I think ISIS, as I call it, is the bright red, oozing, throbbing symptom of a much deeper disease, and that is militant Islam. ISIS is definitely the most immediate symptom of this problem, as you saw, we all saw in Paris just a few weeks ago, with 130 people killed and 350 or so injured in these awful, horrific, barbaric attacks. But if we somehow magically wiped out ISIS, which I think we could do if we focused on it, we'd still have to worry about Al-Qaeda, which is not dead, It's not on the run. It's not disappearance on the run towards us. Boko Haram, Al Kabab, all these other organizations. And this is a horrifying global problem, and I think it's also a problem in this country. You've got people radicalized in the United States. According to James Comey, the director of the FBI, I think there's something like 900 different anti-ISIS investigations in each of our 50 states. So this is a domestic problem. It's an international problem. And I wish it were as bad as ISIS is. It's not just ISIS. It goes well beyond that.
So in your judgment, DeRoy, what should we be doing about this throbbing sore? Just for starters, what is it that we are failing to do at the moment? You've mentioned a number of things. Containing was another of the words that the president has conjured up here. But give us a sense of what your prescription would be for doing something effective about the Islamic State and Syria, I guess, more broadly.
I think the first thing to do is decide that we want to get rid of it. I've heard about containing ISIS, defeating ISIS, destroying is a better term. I prefer the term exterminate. And it has to be done with that sense of urgency and relentlessness. We need to go after these guys and do to them what we did to Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. I was quite astonished to see in the Daily Mail a couple of weeks ago a picture of downtown Raqqa, and there was an area circled where the U.S., to Obama to his credit and the U.S. military to its tremendous credit, dropped a drone on Johnny Jihad, who's one of the top ISIS commanders, the one who we've seen on videotape but beheading people. And I'm glad he's dead. He's gone on to 72 virgins or what have you. But also in that picture about two blocks away was ISIS headquarters. And it looked absolutely pristine. I mean, not a scratch on it. And I thought to myself, my God, we are, 15 months into this engagement, and the headquarters where the Secretary of Defense, if you will, of ISIS and their intelligence chiefs and whatnot huddle every day has not had a nice number of missiles dropped through the top. I believe either the Russians or French went in and took care of that thing. That should have happened a year and a half ago. So I think we have to get very serious about wiping these guys out. I think that means a tremendous carpet bombing of Raqqa. It means when we find their oil trucks, which we just started hitting last week, we don't drop flyers on these guys telling them that they have 45 minutes to run away. We drop the bombs and kill the truck drivers too, because any of those guys can go on and pick up a gun and shoot us at us, become suicide bombers, what have you. And I think ultimately it involves an international group of nations to put boots on the ground and wipe this thing up on the ground. I mean, this thing should have been wiped out a year and a half ago. And the scariest part of it, Frank, is not the people who are over there, but the people who've gone back to France, to Belgium, and maybe even to the United States using their Western passports. And they could be walking among us as I speak.
DeRoy, you're a thoughtful guy. What do you make of the recommendations that we're hearing from a number of quarters these days that in connection with that boots on the ground idea, we ought to be making common cause with the Russians and even with the Iranians to root out the Islamic State? Is that a formula for actually ameliorating the situation or simply creating new problems for us down the road?
Boy, that's a really tough one, Frank. The question in almost any military engagement is what happens afterwards. I think ISIS is so bad you want to wipe ISIS out. I mean, these guys are, there's no way we can cut a deal with these guys or negotiate or reason with them. They just have to be eliminated, exterminated, as I said earlier. I don't know if getting Russia involved in it makes it happen more quickly. If we don't do that, if we don't involve them and they're still on the ground near us, do they shoot at us? That's a very, very tricky needle to try to thread. I do not want to get into bed with the Iranians. I think that just asks for more trouble. I mean, Putin's a thug, but he's a secular thug and not crazy, whereas the Iranians are crazy, thugs and crazy. So if we have to deal with someone else, at least deal with a secular thug.
I worry that it's not so much craziness. They are certainly messianic in their vision, but it is rooted in their, sort of belief in Islamic supremacism. Let me ask you about one other issue that I know you've focused on a lot over the years, DeRoy, and that is this global climate change conference that is now underway in Paris. I talked about it a bit with one of our previous guests, Gordon Chang, from sort of perspective particularly of China. But more broadly, what do you make of the argument that the science is settled on this and there's an urgent need for us to cap at 2 degrees centigrade any future climate warming And is that even remotely possible?
I think that a gentleman by the name of Jim Girard, who runs something called the TrueSpeak Institute, put this very well to me. He said that the science deniers really are the people on the left, the people who are pushing this whole global warming concept. According to satellite data, there has been no measurable warming of Earth's average global temperature for 18 years and 9 months. They keep saying we're warming, we're boiling over. Well, guess what? The kettle is actually cooling rather than boiling. And you can see charts online if you look this up, and you can actually see that the temperatures peaked about 1997 and have been drifting slowly downward ever since. We've not surpassed those temperatures in almost 19 years now. And yet, despite that, you have this international confab going on in a state of emergency about this awful problem that doesn't exist. And in exchange for fighting, sort of like a war on unicorns, fighting a problem that isn't there, we're to shut our economy down and send billions and billions of dollars over to the third world, and I guess eventually just, you know, huddle in the dark in caves. This is taking the progress mankind has made over centuries and putting it in reverse. And it would be bad enough if it were done in service to the solution of a real problem. It's being done in service to the advancement of mythology.
And as you look at the costs, and this is a point that I think we can't emphasize enough for Americans, and that is the sort of lubricant that's being created for this whole global climate, or as you call it, global warming industry, is American largesse in no small measure. $100 billion, I'm told, is supposed to be created in this Greening Climate Fund. Is that justified? And if it's not, can we stop the president from committing us to it, especially if he's not going to submit this as a treaty to the United States Senate?
Frank, everything you said is true, but it's so much worse than you say. In addition to these bailouts and handouts to countries overseas to build them up as competitors of ours while we handcuff ourselves, Obama's Clean Power Plan, if it goes through, is supposed to cost, I think the number is about $380 billion over the next 25 years in terms of reduced personal income. This is according to the Energy Information Administration, which is part of the Department of Energy, which is part of the Obama administration. So these are not my numbers or Ann Coulter's numbers. $380 billion over the next 25 years. Now that will reduce temperatures, expected temperatures, by 0.02 degrees Fahrenheit. I mean, this is like going from 98.6 down to 98.58 if in terms of the human body temperature. If you, let's say global warming really is a problem and you want to reduce the temperature by 1 degree, if you extrapolate that figure, it comes out to, are you sitting down, Frank, $19.1 trillion with a T. So basically take the national debt and double it.
It may even be that it will have absolutely no bearing on the larger climate conditions that are giving rise to warming on a periodic basis in any event. Dory, we have to leave it at that. So much more to talk about. I look forward to doing so with you again. Next up, former acting director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Jack Devine, on the state of war, Middle East and beyond. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. The Obama administration's efforts to defend the controversial nuclear deal with Iran has become ugly, very ugly. Last week, during a speech at American University, the president portrayed opponents of the deal as partisan Republicans in common cause with Death to America chanting Iranian hardliners. The Tablet, a daily online Jewish magazine, ran an editorial on August 7th claiming that the president is using code anti-Semitic language to criticize Jewish Americans for opposing the Iran deal and to blame them if the deal is rejected by Congress. Some liberal pro-Obama groups have gone further and have questioned the loyalty to this country of Jewish members of Congress who oppose the deal, such as New York Senator Chuck Schumer. The president and his supporters are stooping to smearing opponents of the deal because the agreement is so awful and they cannot defend it on its merits. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Jack Devine, a friend and colleague of many years, who today is the founding partner and president of the Arkin Group, LLC, an international risk consulting and intelligence firm. But for 32 years, he served in various positions in the Central Intelligence Agency, including some of its most senior. Indeed, he was the acting director for a time of the agency and also ran operations for it, notably in Latin America, counter-narcotics, and in Afghanistan. Jack, it's a delight to have you with us. Welcome back. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, it's good to be on the show with you, Frank. It always is.
Thank you. Well, let me ask you first and foremost about Afghanistan, Jack. You spent a lot of time there. Obviously, you had an instrumental role in helping to bring down the Soviet invasion of the place. What do you make of what's happening at the moment, and what do you think is in prospect there?
Well, Frank, I think as you've noted, I mean, we're paying far less attention to Afghanistan. You know, one of the things that struck me a few weeks back was, you know, the Afghans looking to possibly find support and cooperation with the Russians. I mean, if you want to talk about coming full cycle from the days of Charlie Wilson, and I think it speaks to our weakening role as we reduce our presence. You know, I've been very pessimistic about Afghanistan from the beginning. I wrote a Wall Street Journal op-ed back in 2010 saying that they'll go back to their tribal, you know, behavior once we leave, and the money's not pouring in there at the same level. And our best long-term solution is probably, you know, finding a way to cooperate with specific tribes and have CIA and special forces below the radar helping where you can. But I think the whole process of nation building there was wrong-footed.
Yeah. And I guess, Jack, does that mean that you anticipate the inevitability of the return of the Taliban as a force in Afghanistan, if perhaps one that can be counterbalanced by, a Northern Alliance kind of redux, but still is going to be very much part of the Afghan scene as we leave?
Yeah, I think we have to be very concerned that we're going to see a return of the Taliban. I mean, the big players after we leave will frankly be the Pakistanis and the Chinese from a financial point of view. The Iranians, of course, will try and dabble there, and so will the Russians and the Indians. But at the end of the day, Pakistan and its tribal relationships in the southern part of Afghanistan.
And they had a big say when they brought the Taliban to power in the first place, as I recall.
And that's absolutely true. They're also very helpful to us when we tried to get rid of the Russians. So the question is, how do you work with them? I mean, how do we work with the Chinese and what influence we may have there as well? But I think at the end of the day, the only counterweight to the Taliban is working with the Northern Alliance. It is what worked back in the 80s. It is what worked when we brought the Taliban the last time. And I think people sometimes miss the fact this is not a united country. It's just a series of tribes that, you know, to the highest bidder, not to be too crass here, goes the spoils.
Yeah. And this is a point that we've lost sight of as we've pursued, of course, a federal government operation that has not done the job, needless to say. We're talking with Jack Devine. He's the author of, among other things, Good Hunting, An American Spymaster's Story, a very, very compelling memoir of his time in the Central Intelligence Agency. Jack, let me turn to something else that you've been working on, and we talked about it a bit earlier with DeRoy Murdoch. I wonder what your thoughts are at the moment about our managing another manifestation of the jihad, the Islamic State. What should we be doing there? What role should the Central Intelligence Agency be playing? And if any, is that something that could meet the needs of having so-called boots on the ground?
Let me see if I can roll it back in a couple points, Frank. First, you know, I think Paris is a real eye-opener, certainly to the Europeans, but it also signifies
Islamic State attacks there.
Yes.
Yeah.
This represents, as you know, a change in strategy. In other words, they are actually going to take violence and bring it to bear in, you know, Western capitals. Now, the question will be, can they sustain it? Will they sustain it? And that remains to be seen. But if they're determined, the big issue on terrorism in Western states that are democratic and have open borders and, you know, have democratic procedures, the issue is the will of ISIS. Do they really see this as a strategic advantage to go against us? And if so, then we're not going to be able to fight that part back. We're going to have to take the battle to the home front, and that's to the so-called caliphate. In other words, you really have to destroy ISIS. You can only do so much defensive work. I know people talk about cooperation and more police. The French are going to put 5,000 more police over the next year or two on the ground. There's only so much you can do in an open society. I mean, low-end use of arms, going into supermarkets, stores, theaters. You had this crazy guy out killing three people in Planned Parenthood. I mean, it just isn't that hard in Democratic, but when people are prepared to die themselves. So I think the battle, if they continue that, we're not going to be able to avoid going right against the caliphate. The question is whether you do it now, you do it later. And I think there'll be a point where there's critical mass. That's where enough people are so upset they can say, look, let's get together, and that's my view on this. There was an opportunity when the Russian plane was, commercial plane was shot down, and when the attacks in Paris took place, to put together an alliance that goes against ISIS. And I think that's the first thing. Now, a lot of people are going to get upset, but I mean, I think you hold Assad. I think there's a deal that can be made with the Russians, but the first thing to do is you got to destroy ISIS. If they continue bringing terrorism, and I think we should be on a higher alert, and I mean that as a population rather than government, we should be on a higher alert here in the United States. I mean, what keeps you awake at night is something in Washington or in New York, a terrorist event carried out by ISIS, and we all know just how vulnerable we are to that.
We do. Those of us, at least, that are paying attention, I think most of us seem to take it for granted that somehow that won't happen here. But Jack Devine, you understand this enemy very well and know that it is not only entirely possible, it is almost certainly in the cards. Just on the Russia business, because I did talk about that a moment ago with Jeroy Murdoch, as a man who went up against them in Afghanistan and beat them there, do you anticipate that we can actually have a modus vivendi with the Russians against a mutual enemy like the Islamic State without having longer-term negative consequences, notably given Putin's hostility to us of legitimating him and perhaps emboldening him further?
I think one of the big differences between when we would go toe-to-toe with them back in, well, starting 1917, if you will, but is, you know, there's no ideology there. Putin doesn't have a winning sort of philosophy of how the world should be functioning. He doesn't have a philosophy about how his own government should function. So there's no ideological basis for Putin in this. It really makes him less of a threat. And plus, his country was greatly weakened after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And even today, with the oil prices being with they are, you know, they're a smaller, much smaller player than they used to be. But what you have is a guy who is a tough player, a KGB trained guy, who's a hard-faced pragmatist and realist, and his objective is to make Russia as a country, you know, strong.
But isn't that basically fundamentally going to require weakening NATO, weakening us, weakening others who stand in opposition to him? Jack, this is a subject for a much longer conversation. I'm afraid we are hard out of time, and I hate doing this because I always want to go on and on with you, but we'll do it again soon. In the meantime, thank you very much for your great service to our country at the Central Intelligence Agency and that you're rendering now at the Arkin Group. Keep it up and come back to us again very soon. Look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.